The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
What types of engagement are good and what types of engagement are bad? I normally try to answer that question by thinking about who is it producing value for and how is that value distributed? And it's very easy to make the argument that simply giving people more of what will capture their attention is or can be bad for them. So I think as people started to realize that in the last 5 to 7 years, there developed this critique around the term. And I agree with the critique. I just think that if you sort of take that critique to its logical conclusion, it's, well, you know, we shouldn't try to have engagement. Well, a platform with no engagement produces zero value. So that's not the answer.
I'm Quinta Jurassic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast. July 7th, 2022. Algorithms. We hear a lot about them. They drive social media platforms, and according to some popular understandings, are responsible for a great deal of what's wrong about the internet today, and maybe the downfall of democracy itself. But what exactly are algorithms? And given that they're not going away, what should they be designed to do? We're discussing that on today's episode of our Arbiters of Truth series on the online information ecosystem. Evelyn Duick and I spoke with Jonathan Stray, senior scientist at the Berkeley Center for Human Compatible AI, and someone who has thought a lot about what we mean when we say the word algorithm, and also when we discuss things like engagement on social media and amplification. He helped us pin down a more precise understanding of what those terms mean and why that precision is so important in crafting good technology policy. We also talked about what role social media algorithms do and don't play in stoking political polarization, and how they might be designed to decrease polarization instead. It's the Lawfare Podcast, July 7th. What we talk about when we talk about algorithms.
So Jonathan, we are going to spend our time talking about recommendation algorithms, obviously, given that's what you study. But I think in order to get everyone sort of on the same page, we should start to get some definitions, because I think the definitions in this area can be pretty slippery or misunderstood, and that can result in people talking past each other. So let's start with what might be a stupid question, but does seem very important. What is an algorithm?
Oh gosh, we're going to start there, huh? Okay, well, you've all heard a definition like, you know, it's a series of steps to achieve some result, more specifically a series of steps run by a computer. But in this discussion, often what people are talking about when they say that is, you know, Twitter used to be just a reverse chronological feed of the posts from the people I follow. And now there is some opaque or black box or sort of unexplainable system underneath that is deciding how to allocate my attention. So in this discussion, that's normally what people mean when they say, you know, what is the algorithm behind the platform?
So another term that I think is worth nailing down and that you've done some work on is the idea of engagement. And I think the sort of idea about social media now has often become that it optimizes for engagement rather than other values like productive debate or truth or diversity of opinions. But the question I think is, you know, what actually is engagement and how can it be measured? Because of course there are a lot of different kinds of engagement, like how long someone spends on the site or how often they click on things or something like that. So how would you define it?
Right. So engagement is this weird word that used to be this thing that only like, UX designers and advertisers talked about. And it's somehow become the center of this mainstream controversy, which is super interesting. So I've spent some time with colleagues trying to sort of unpack this a little bit. And we sort of read all of the history of what this word means. And it up until about 5 years ago, it was almost always mentioned as a positive thing. So, you know, people building products would say, well, you know, if a product is engaging, it's more than merely usable. It's the user gets into sort of a flow state or has some sort of positive experience with this. And this was very much a goal. If you read the like HCI literature from, you know, 20, 30 years ago, advertisers want engagement because they want you to be, of course, excited about the thing that they're trying to sell you. Journalists began talking about engagement maybe 15 years ago when they began to realize that online media worked differently than broadcast or print media, when you always had the choice to go to a different source of information. The idea of having you not merely reading the article, but engaged, being sort of active, became very important. And they started to talk about engagement as a two-way process as well. So in journalism, when they think about engagement, they think about not only are we, you know, putting things out for the audience, but we're getting something back from them, hopefully something more than their interest, you know, their comments, their information, maybe just sharing with other people, and ultimately journalistic impact. So up until, you know, let's call it like 2015, 2016, this was a thing that everybody wanted. And then the discourse changed because people started talking about the harmful side effects of recommender algorithms, which is probably a term we should define in a moment. And they said, well, you know, they're not really optimizing for what's good for us. They're optimizing for engagement. And what they meant was something like optimizing for clicks or optimizing for attention. And so in certain circles, there's been this shift in the discourse where engagement is bad. So I recently did a piece with Pri Bengani and Luke Thorburn, where we tried to just define engagement and talk about when is it good and when is it bad. And if this audience will suffer through it, I'd like to actually read that definition and parse it out.
Yeah, no, that'd be great. Please do.
All right. So here we go. There's four parts. Engagement is a set of user behaviors generated in the normal course of interaction with the platform, which are thought to correlate with value to the user, the platform, or other stakeholders. So first part, it's a set of user behaviors, right? It's not what people are thinking or feeling or doing off the platform. It's user behaviors on the platform. Generated in the normal course of interaction with the platform. So we're not talking about like adjusting controls or taking survey. This is just like what you do every day when you're using the app, right? Which are thought to correlate with value. Okay, this is why everybody uses engagement, because these signals, you know, a click isn't necessarily valuable in itself, but it's thought to be a proxy for something that we care about, say, you know, subscribers. Correlate with value to the user, the platform, or other stakeholders. This engagement is a multi-stakeholder construct. It's inherently a social thing where multiple people have interests. So a simple example of that is on YouTube. Obviously, you want to recommend the videos that users are going to like in some sense. But you also need to give enough attention to a wide enough variety of creators that it's worth it to them to stay on the platform. So there you go. There's my four-barreled definition.
Can I pause on that last element, though? Because it seems very broad. When you say user, platform, or other stakeholders, mm-hmm. That strikes me as almost everything. And that if you could give me an example of something that would fall outside that category, it also strikes me that they might be in conflict sometimes. So, yeah. You know, what is a value to the platform? And I guess this is actually the debate that comes up, right? Is that people think that platforms are, or the trope is that platforms are optimizing for their engagement to the extent that it produces value for them, namely through advertising and attention. But that is at odds with the value of engagement for democracy or politicians or users themselves who don't want to spend all of this time on platforms, even if they actually do.
Right, exactly. Okay, so you can attack the use of engagement along any of these axes. So let's start with the, you know, value to whom, and ideally value to everyone involved, right? So platforms, many of them are a two-sided market, which means that they have to keep both the creators and the consumers happy. So Spotify is another excellent example of this. So they have published some papers talking about a diversity metric that they use. And they say that a playlist or a stream is diverse to the extent that it contains songs from different tiers of popularity. So they're interested in making sure you're exposed to less popular songs. Now, why do they do that? There's actually several reasons. So one of them is a sort of like musical exploration thing, right? They would like your experience to be something other than the top 40. But another one is the fact that they have to please the artists. And cultural markets generally tend to suffer from an effect called superstar economics, where a small number of creators capture almost all of the attention. So that might be great if you're a star, but it's not great if you're not a star. And so most platforms that are two-sided markets in this way have some sort of distribution or sort of smoothing of the attention built in. And this is how Spotify does it. So that's value to the consumers and the producers when they get this right. Now, obviously, Spotify also has to capture some of that value for itself or it ceases to exist. And that is true whether you're... this is one of the things that I think often gets lost in this discussion. It's not the business model. It doesn't matter whether you're ad-supported, you are supported by subscribers, or you are a nonprofit, or you are government-supported. You have to capture... you have to produce value for somebody. You have to produce engagement. Otherwise, your funding dries up, right? Either you have no subscribers or, you know, your funder says, well, nobody listens to your podcast. Why would I fund this? Or even the BBC is continually under pressure to show that people actually watch their shows. So I actually think that the, you know, it's the business model stupid diagnosis is misguided. I don't think that's what's happening here.
I want to go back to something you said before about how before maybe 5 or 6 years ago, engagement was a good thing and people that, you know, not only in social media platforms, but in other walks of life, including journalists, were chasing. Why and how is it, in your view, that engagement and, you know, the algorithm became dirty words? Because I think that's been a really interesting kind of cultural shift to watch.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. One of the analogies I draw is between engagement and profit, right? So ideally, a company is profitable because it is producing something that is valuable to its consumers and, you know, obviously valuable to itself, right? But we know that there's a lot of dishonest or unethical or harmful ways to make money. So profit has got this similar sort of double valence. It is something that every company chases. It's something that is taught in business schools, you know, almost obsessively, you know, how do we make a profitable company? And at the same time, it is this term that is at the center of this huge history of critique going back hundreds of years, saying, no, you know, optimizing for profit is not it. So, you know, when is profit good and when is profit bad is sort of ends up being the question, right? And you get a very similar question about engagement. What types of engagement are good and what types of engagement are bad? And I normally try to answer that question by thinking about who is it producing value for and how is that value distributed? And it's very easy and very true to make the argument that simply giving people more of what will capture their attention is or can be bad for them. So I think as people started to realize that, in you know, the last, you know, 5 to 7 years, they're developed this critique around the term, and I agree with the critique. I just think that if you sort of take that critique to its logical conclusion, it's, well, you know, we shouldn't try to have engagement. Well, a platform with no engagement produces zero value, so that's not the answer either. I think the question is, when is engagement aligned with the values of various stakeholders, and when is it not?
Yeah, so in response to the kind of it's the business model stupid idea, I guess platforms might say or have said something along the lines of like, this is what people want, stupid. And mm-hmm. I'm thinking of the blog post that Nick Clegg, the president of global affairs at Meta wrote that caused a bit of an uproar. It's hard to summarize 5,000 words, but I think the title gives a good idea of the gist of his argument, which is you and the algorithm, it takes two to tango. Mm-hmm. He gives this weird analogy of a couple making dinner and one person goes out to the supermarket and picks the ingredients, and then they bring it home and their partner cooks something from those ingredients. They don't get to, the first person doesn't get to choose, but it's obviously only including the things that they picked out and they wanted. You know, that strikes me as a bit of a dysfunctional way for a couple to choose to fix dinner, but you know, that's a setting that aside. You know, I think the thrust of his point is clear that algorithms give you what you want. You do select the elements as you're clicking around the site, as you're revealing your preferences. And so this is not, you know, social media platforms manipulating people, but it's responding to their desires. What did you make of that post and sort of the subsequent debate and backlash against it?
Right. Gosh. Well, I think there were a lot of interesting elements in there. And just from a sort of politics point of view, he was exactly the wrong person to make those arguments.
It's weird that they roll him out to make, I mean, he is sort of Facebook's punching bag, but I don't know exactly why they think he is the best spokesman for anything, really. But there you go.
Yeah. So let's see. What can we say about that? As you said, it's 5,000 words. So he says a lot of things. So I think there's sort of like, there's sort of a truth and an evasion in that line of argument, right? So the truth is that the output of large algorithmic systems are a combination of the algorithm and the user behavior and also the operators of the platform, right, who are constantly tweaking things. So it's an emergent system. And Dean Eccles at MIT has talked about this and makes this point very, very eloquently, actually in his Senate testimony, which is, there's a written version of it, which is really good. I don't know if you do links, but it's one of my favorite. Anyway, so he's got this diagram, which is sort of a feedback loop between the content presented to the user, the content that the user clicks, and the signals back to the content creators. So if you change the algorithm or the users change their interests, that changes the incentives for what is produced. And in turn, what is shown. So there really is this sense of sort of this complicated interacting system. And we know from published research that when you change a platform, when you change what people are shown, it takes somewhere in the range of 3 to 6 months for people's behavior to change and get back into an equilibrium, which may not be the equilibrium you wanted, right? So like a very simple example is that, you know, you may decide that you want people to be nicer to each other, so you downrank comments where people fight. Well, what may happen if people really want to fight is they may start fighting through another channel, through, you know, Instant Messenger, or by like, you know, subtweeting each other, right? So you don't necessarily get to control the dynamics of the platform just by changing the algorithm. So I think that part is true. And there, one of the implications of that is we can't necessarily fix democracy by fixing social media. If only it was that easy. But I honestly don't think they have that large an effect. I think they could be part of the solution. I think on balance, they're probably contributing to the problem and we should fix that. But, you know, if only we could change society through code, that would be amazing. Where I think Clegg is being a little deceptive is that there's now substantial research that suggests that there are problems with how these algorithms are built and the goals and metrics that are used to manage them. So that, I think, is a conversation we should be having, right? So if we don't think that optimizing for engagement is the right thing, then what is it that we should be optimizing for? And he invokes this sort of revealed preference arguments. I'm sure many of your listeners will be familiar with this strain of thinking. And this is another thing that I've written about recently. Revealed preferences says that you can tell what people want by looking at the choices they make. And the problem with that argument is it's just not true. There's all kinds of reasons that people make choices that are not reflective of their true desires and motivations and needs. So for example, they could be misinformed. They could be coerced. They may not be able to afford the thing that they really want. They may misunderstand what the outcome is going to be. They may mispredict their own future happiness. So that argument that you can determine what people want based on what they select is just false. And that is why I've bracketed engagement as a set of behaviors, because I want to say, well, as long as you're using only behaviors, you're always going to miss something. So we need some other source of information about what the actual effects of these platforms on people are.
Okay, so there's this question then of optimizing for different things, and you've written that, you know, no real platform optimizes solely for engagement, that that's a pretty reductive perception of how platforms work. And so I'm curious for you to talk a little bit more about the other kinds of signals that they take into account, and also, you know, how different platforms might be different in this respect. I presume that there's not some monolith where Silicon Valley gets together and says, this is the value that we should all, you know, pursue. But then, you know, what causes those differences between different platforms? Is it just, you know, different bets on the business model, or how do different companies think about that?
Always asking the easy questions. Okay, well, I mean, I can tell you what I know, which is there's a few other categories of things that platforms optimize for other than engagement. So one of them is what has come to be called integrity metrics. So this is, you know, your misinformation, hate speech, criminal activity, you know, sexual material. There's this really long list of things, which I'm sure your listeners are super familiar with at this point. So some of those things, there are triage systems which just, you know, outright remove anything that seems suspicious. Like some of that stuff is just not supposed to be available for recommendation, full stop. But some of it's fuzzier. So some of it, like, you know, news source credibility. So, for example, Facebook does this survey which asks, you know, shows you a URL and says, you know, A, have you heard of this source? B, do you trust it? And there's some external research that this actually correlates pretty well with other measures of news trust. Like crowdsourcing source trust is actually, you know, a better idea than it might sound. So that gives you a sort of very approximate, you know, is this item credible kind of signal. And you don't want to make that a hard or binary signal, because you don't want to just sort of completely exclude sources that are, you know, below, let's say 50% trusted, right? Maybe they're really good on certain types of topics. So instead it becomes a sort of weight or score, and you sort of, you know, you downrank things a little bit if their credibility signal isn't looking so hot. So there's this whole set of sort of soft integrity metrics. And then another source that platforms use are survey data. So this appears in a variety of ways, right? So basically every platform does a sort of user satisfaction survey. Twitter has experimented with surveys like, you know, do you remember this conversation? Did you find it informative? Facebook does a survey called Worth Your Time. YouTube does this survey where they actually ask you, you know, did you find this video, you know, informative, life-changing, inspirational, boring, right? They've got this sort of really funny set of categories. I don't know how many videos on YouTube are life-changing. I don't think I've ever experienced a life-changing YouTube video, but one hopes. So they do these surveys, and then they use them in a couple ways. One is in A/B tests. So they'll make a change to the algorithm. They will get the survey data from the baseline and the modified group, and they'll say, oh, okay, well, this change, you know, makes people more likely to say that they think that the things we're recommending are worth their time. The other thing that is happening, which is really interesting, is that many companies use the survey data to build models of how people would answer the survey, which sounds kind of crazy, but if you think about it, it's not really a different problem than predicting whether somebody is going to click a like button, right? Like a survey is just a bunch of buttons you can click, and so you're trying to predict which button they click. And my understanding is that these models are not that great. I mean, it's a hard thing to predict. So the correlation with actual survey results might be like, you know, R squared equals 0.2, which, you know, if you're not down that rabbit hole, is like, you know, pretty bad, like better than a coin flip, but not that much better than a coin flip. Even so, you can extract useful information from such a model, right? Sort of one, call it one bit of data. In particular, that model might tell you whether you should expect that this change will make a certain metric, survey metric, better or worse. So these models are actually being used to sort of run pseudo A/B tests. And they're also increasingly being used in the core ranker. And there's a YouTube paper from 2019 where you can actually see this. They actually say that one of the ranking signals they use is they try to predict how someone would rate that recommendation from the survey that I talked about a moment ago. And if they think someone would rate it higher, that becomes part of the scoring process in much the same way that imagining that someone would click on something. So I think surveys are very interesting because they are, by my definition anyway, not engagement. They're not behavioral data generated in the normal course of the platform. You are getting information some other way. And of course, this is the way out of the sort of tangle of revealed preferences. If you can't figure out what people actually want just by watching what they do, then maybe you should ask them. And that's the intuition there.
So this may be a bit of a silly question, but how many people actually fill out those surveys? Because I will say I have definitely gotten the, you know, did you find this video valuable? Did you find this conversation valuable question? And I personally, I never answer those. So apologies to the social scientists. You know, do we have a sense of who is answering those questions, like what that looks like? And I guess that gets to a broader question of how reliable, or do we have a sense of how reliable the data is that these platforms are building these models from?
Yeah, no, great questions. You know, now we're really getting into the weeds of, you know, what is a survey and what can it tell you? So only a small fraction of people will ever see a survey. In fact, I'm given to understand that platforms have a survey budget. They say, you know, we're going to bother each person no more than once every 6 months. And so actually internally, there's management where teams compete to ask questions. So that's kind of interesting. One of the primary challenges with survey data is it's extremely sparse. So, you know, I did a back of the envelope calculation at one point, which suggested that on a typical platform, survey data is 10 million times more scarce than engagement data. And this is why everybody uses engagement data. It's because it's the only thing that's cheap and plentiful. And it, you know, if you sort of squint at it just right, it actually does show genuine user value, you know, at least sometimes. So that's sort of the first problem with surveys, is this sparsity problem. The next question is, you know, are people honest, and, you know, do we have selection bias? You can kind of work around the selection bias problems. That is, you know, people self-selecting or all of a particular demographic or whatever. Because if you're the platform, you have to some degree those demographics. So you can do sort of rebalancing tricks. People can lie on surveys. Best practice is to do qualitative testing beforehand to make sure that people at least understand what they're being asked. There's manipulation checks, there's attention checks, there's a whole, you know, science of doing surveys. So that will probably work. What I'd like to introduce into the discussion is the idea of paying people for survey data. Now, this happens, but it's not super common. You weren't offered money for filling out those surveys. But it's kind of interesting that in search, it is long established that, you know, Google and Bing and all of these people, they pay tens of thousands of search raters. They give them this, 100-page document, and they say, this is how to evaluate search results. And, a certain fee for, you know, every A-B search result that they rate. But we don't really do this for ranking or for surveys. So I think one of the most interesting directions here is, well, if you want to solve the sparsity and quality issues with survey data, and that's what you need to drive rankings and ensure that engagement is aligned with the things that you actually care about, then maybe you should just pay for that information. So I'm trying to get the industry to move in that direction.
Okay, so a lot of this conversation has centered around user preferences and trying to find, you know, better proxies for that. But another view might be, well, let's not pursue user preferences. Let's pursue some other value. And you've written about designing recommendation systems to depolarize. I'm curious for you to talk a little bit about that and what kind of tools might be available to do that.
Right. Yeah. So a lot of my work focuses on the intersection of AI and conflict, which I feel is tremendously underexplored. If you're an existential risk fan, I would point out that, war can be an existential risk. But there's not really a lot of work at this intersection, except for this idea that, you know, platforms are polarizing us, they're sort of tearing us apart. So that is a complicated statement, right? What's polarization? How, you know, which platform, under what circumstances, how do we measure this effect? And I'm not really going to try to summarize the state of that debate. I think there's two recent articles in The Atlantic that sort of do a good job presenting the sort of pro and con sides of that. Let's say that the evidence is mixed. There are certainly contexts in which usage of recommender-driven platforms seem to increase certain measures of polarization that we think are important. So let's just sort of bracket that argument and say that at least sometimes it does matter. So having done that, then the question is, okay, well, how do we change these algorithms? So broadly speaking, the types of solutions that have been proposed are diversification. The idea is that you shouldn't just see arguments or information from one side, where the sides are defined relative to whatever the local context is, right? So there's very obviously sort of a left versus right thing going on in the US. In other parts of the world, you know, those divisions have different names and different histories. But usually there's sort of an in-group, out-group thing. Okay, so that was the sort of filter bubble hypothesis, the sort of echo chamber. There's been a lot of ways to talk about that. But the problem is that jumps to the solution without testing it in an ecologically valid way. And when you expose people to counter-ideological information, sometimes it works in the sense of making them more empathetic, more understanding, improving the conflict dynamics, and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it increases polarization. So we know this from really the psychological literature on intergroup contact going back 100 years, but also more recently from on-platform experiments. So this is where, you know, I keep sort of banging this drum and saying we need to bring ideas and practices from conflict dynamics and peace building and conflict transformation and all of these professions which deal with conflict. And they could have told you that. In fact, they did tell us that. There was a very pithy remark at a conference I was at 10 years ago talking about this problem of online conflict dynamics. And this woman said, unmoderated chat polarizes. And that's it right there, right? You only get this depolarizing effect under certain specific conditions. Okay, so what are those conditions? Well, there's a bunch of research sort of going down there. No one will be surprised to hear that civility or something like civility matters. You know, it sounds almost stupid, but when people are nicer, you're more likely to listen to them. There's an exercise used in conflict work called perspective taking, where you ask someone to take the perspective of the other. You know, there's sort of a set of sort of standard psychological techniques. You don't want to talk to the most extreme person on the other side. You want to talk to someone who's like, you know, has, you know, a different opinion from you, but not too different. There's these types of things. And so these types of ideas from intergroup contact theory are starting to be applied to people who are thinking about the problem of online contact and social media. But I think we need to go a step further. I think that I think there's two fundamental problems that this type of like designing a lab experiment sort of line of work doesn't get to. The first is that online platforms are very, very complicated ecosystems. And I really question the ecological validity of a lab experiment and saying, okay, well, we did this experiment and now we're going to say that it applies across Twitter and Facebook and Snapchat and Instagram. Oh, and also every country and every conflict in the world. Like, that's just bonkers. That is not the case. The first thing is we're going to have to measure the outcomes that we're interested in on platform. I've been, like many scholars, interested in a set of measures called effective polarization, which is kind of like, not do you disagree with that guy, but do you dislike him? And there's been a bunch of scholarship that has been looking at the rise of effective polarization in the US. You know, for example, we're much less likely to marry or hire someone who has an opposite political view than we are. Which is really kind of sad because, of course, those intergroup ties are exactly what contributes to greater understanding. There are other ways to measure polarization. There's a big literature on it. There are folks who say that effective polarization is not a good predictor of outcomes like violence or a democratic backsliding. But let's just bracket that and say that there's some way that we can measure polarization that is predictive for the bad outcomes that we care about. So if that's true, then what we should be doing is when we do our A/B tests, rather than saying, you know, was this post worth your time? We should say, you know, did you feel better or worse about your whatever your outgroup is after this comment thread? Do you feel that you understand them better after you read this forum post? We should be looking at those sorts of things as A/B metrics. And then there's another level, which is the algorithmic level. Right. So my model of how you tune a platform for social outcomes goes policy, then operations, which is the sort of management and A/B test level, then algorithm. And so now we're talking about the algorithmic level. And there, as many scholars have pointed out, it may be necessary to incorporate measures of polarization as a ranking signal in the algorithm itself to prevent runaway optimization that polarizes. In other words, something has to prevent the algorithm from discovering, oh, hey, if I show you inflammatory articles, you will spend more time reading them. There has to be a counterbalancing signal at the algorithmic level. And the way you could attempt to do that, or one way you could attempt to do that, is very much how I talked about how these platforms are using survey proxy models, sort of the same idea, right? You try to build a model that predicts, if I show you this comment thread, what will you say on a survey asking you about a polarization measure? And it's going to be a pretty bad predictor, but it's probably enough to, as we would say in computer science, to regularize the process, to sort of prevent it from drifting off in extreme directions.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022. And they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of, called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep
acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
So that's fascinating, and there's an enormous amount to dig into. Before we go further, though, I do want to sort of raise what I think is the counterargument that I've heard increasingly often when we talk about polarization. And the main person, I think, who's made this argument, among others, is Daniel Kreese at UNC, essentially making the argument that, you know, talking about polarization in a kind of a content neutral sense ignores the very important question of who is polarized against who and what people are polarized over. So in Kreese's argument, you know, the United States right now, polarization includes a sharp disagreement along party lines over things like, is democracy good? Or, you know, are non-white people equal citizens? So with that in mind, playing devil's advocate a little, should we be designing recommendation systems to depolarize if polarization is over core values?
We are really getting to the good stuff here. Okay, I'm glad you brought this up. So now we're having a conversation that is really nothing to do with algorithms, but of course, everything to do with what we want our algorithms to do. So let's dig in here. Yeah. So sometimes fighting is necessary, right? This is the concept of a just war. And people have been arguing about when fighting is necessary for, you know, since the beginning of civilization. So I think that's the sort of core insight of, you know, the argument against trying to depolarize. So there is this tension. There is a tension between peace and justice. Is the sort of most general way I would put it. And you can see this in a lot of different ways. So one of the classic ways this plays out is, you know, say there's an authoritarian regime, which for the sake of argument, we'll say is, you know, unequivocally bad, and, you know, it gets overthrown by a democratic regime. Okay, should the new regime prosecute people of the old regime? Right. And, you know, so think about that for a minute. Right. So justice says, absolutely, we should make sure that they're held accountable, that they go to prison, that they're never involved in civilized society again. The peace argument says, no, that, you know, think of how many people that is. Are you going to do that to 10,000 civil servants? What about their families? You know, this is going to deepen a division that is going to last generations. You know, you can't just exclude thousands of people from civic life forever. So in many contexts, there's this very real tension between the two. And I am very partial to a theory of conflict called conflict transformation, which has become, at this point, I think the dominant paradigm in international peacebuilding work over the last two or three decades. So not conflict resolution. Conflict resolution says we are going to end this conflict because we don't like conflict. We think conflict is bad. And in many ways, conflict is bad, right? When you start to talk about, you know, physical violence against people's bodies, that is an outcome we would really, really like to avoid, right? That you get intergenerational trauma, like that's, it's a bad deal and you want to stop that. But you don't want authoritarian pacification. If you apply enough force and put enough police on the ground, you can make people stop fighting. But that's not a free and just society. So instead, conflict transformation starts from a different place. It says, conflict is normal. It is a normal part of human interactions. It's a normal part of how societies change for the better. What we would like is good conflict, not bad conflict. And then you start to ask the question, well, what does good conflict look like? How can we tell it apart from bad conflict? And to provide some intuition about what that question is getting at, think about the arguments you've had, maybe with someone close to you. Sometimes they got ugly, right? You said some things you didn't mean, feelings were hurt, you caused damage that you're going to have to repair later. You know, it really went to that ugly place. And sometimes, instead, it was hard. You heard some truths that were really hard to bear, but, you know, they were true. And it's better that you know, and you better that you understand people, and you can move on from a place of understanding and empathy. Right, so that's sort of on a personal level, the intuition between good and bad conflict. And I'll throw in a pitch here. I actually edit a weekly newsletter called the Better Conflict Bulletin, which is all about coverage of the American domestic political conflict, not from the sense of what just happened, but from the sense of what is the most productive response to what just happened? How can we have a better fight? And that's, I think, the question we need to push on when we think about the design of our platforms.
Yeah, I mean, I think the points you make about thinking about conflict resolution as a field in context of this are particularly interesting right now, because I will say, you know, wearing my other hat where I write about sort of the post-Trump era in the Justice Department, we're seeing a lot of debate about, do we want a prosecution of the former president, or and what dangers does that create, and what dangers does it create if we're not in that circumstance? So I'm sure I'm not telling you anything that you don't know, but it does occur to me that, you know, often when we talk about fields like conflict resolution and conflict studies, those are seen as kind of very different from the political environment in the United States. But unfortunately, right now, they're extremely apropos, and applying them to social media seems like only one way in which that's the case.
Yeah, there is a sort of a pretty significant movement of folks with international experience in conflict zones. And when I say conflict zone, I mean war, right? I mean violent conflict, who are moving back to look at the U.S. domestic conflict, which I would characterize as a largely pre-violent conflict, right? But we're really starting to transpose theories about how do you deal with societies who are fighting a kinetic war, you know, sort of ideas of what we've learned about conflict and the intractability and you know, how all of that stuff plays out. And we're bringing it back now to societies that are experiencing democratic backsliding. And part of the reason for that is there's a growing body of work. There's a group of scholars who are actually comparative political scientists, which means that they study politics by looking across different countries. And so Jennifer McCoy is one of the big names here. And they have started to put this together, this theory of pernicious polarization. So this is like, when is polarization bad, right? So, or, you know, more bluntly, bad conflict. This is the bad kind of conflict. And one of the things they see is that periods of high polarization precede episodes of democratic backsliding when you look across countries and across time. So and then, you know, with some sort of further work on this, they are making an argument that it's causal, that actually polarization leads to authoritarianism and other types of democratic erosion. And so that, I think, is an argument for focusing on polarization suitably defined as a variable that we want to manage and not simply a symptom of something deeper. But I mean, you know, Daniel Kreis and sort of people making that point are correct, right? What we want is peace and justice, and they are going to be in tension. And as happens so often on this show, you can't have everything that you want. There are different equities and different rights, and they're very important. And so you have to choose a path that tries to respect all of the things that we care about as much as we can.
So I think maybe the reason why this hasn't got a lot of attention or hasn't been the priorities. It all sounds quite scary or charged in terms of asking platforms to design their system to pursue these kinds of things. Like, if they don't want to be arbiters of truth, do they really want to be arbiters of, you know, justice or peace? And, you know, do we really want them to? Which, you know, the answer may be yes, like, it, but it, you can understand why there's been a inclination to want to steer clear of that. And, you know, this is where the sort of idea of content neutral interventions comes up a lot more, rather than sort of content based or values based interventions. And of course, that's, you know, a little bit of a red herring, because nothing can be purely neutral and there is no neutral. But, you know, there is some sort of attractiveness to the idea that platforms, you know, if part of the problem is the dynamics of the platforms that they create, then, you know, instead of looking at the particular content in question, you can look at the various behaviors around it, or the various sort of dynamics that that content is producing, without looking at what exactly it says. And so there are a number of sort of interventions that you can think of along these lines. I think maybe one of the most popular or well-known ones is the idea of like a circuit breaker, where once a post starts to go viral or gets lots of engagement, however you define that, the circulation of that post is slowed or restricted in some ways. For example, it stops getting recommended into other people's feed, and that the idea there would be that it's stopping the spread of inflammatory content. And that might be good inflammatory content, or it might be, you know, damaging inflammatory content. But the idea being that if the harmful dynamic here is the overemphasis on spreading, you know, inflammatory stuff very quickly, that overall, on balance, that would be a good intervention. I'm curious what you think of the idea of content neutral interventions rather than any sort of like values based ones. Do you think they have promise, and what kinds of things, if yes, what kinds of things should platforms be thinking about?
Yeah, really interesting. Yeah. So, I mean, broadly speaking, I agree that content neutrality is a bit of a myth. But I do think that procedural fairness is a coherent concept. So, you know, it's not that the platform has no values, or that, you know, code is law doesn't apply here, but that people can expect to be treated in a certain way. And so I think that's a very, very promising idea, maybe sort of to get out of that. And that's why you see these sort of, you know, elaborate sets of public community standards documents and so forth. In terms of circuit breaker specifically, I think they're a very interesting idea. I think they're probably a good idea. They're, you know, facially content neutral. I think they are probably essential to manage the sort of acute effects of conflict, right? So in particular, acts of violence, especially politically motivated violence, are extremely polarizing. And so you want to think carefully about how those are reported and distributed, because they create feedback cycles, right? This is one of the conflict dynamics is always about feedback cycles. And so you want to try to break that feedback cycles and dampen out the disturbances instead of having them amplified through a feedback in the system. And so that's where I think circuit breakers can be really helpful. But to manage the sort of long-term effects of conflict, I think we're going to need something else. And, you know, there's a few ways you could try to design a content neutral version of that. So, for example, you could look at changes in the structure of the social network. So some ridiculous fraction of people have, you know, ended a relationship with a friend or a family member because of politics since 2016. It's something like 30% now, right? Like, you know, if you don't believe X, unfollow me now, right? This has become sort of part of our online world. So that is a destruction of the social fabric. And that's one of the reasons that conflict is so bad for society, is because it destroys the bonds that allow us to trust each other and to work together. So you could, for example, look at whether when a particular type of content is posted, or let's say conversations in a particular group, whether people break friend connections. So that could be one way to try to do this in a content neutral way. But, you know, in the end, I think you're going, as you're really familiar with, I'm sure, there's really no value-free approach here, and I don't think we should be trying to find a value-free approach. I think we should put a, you know, a line in the sand and say, you know, yes, we actually do care about conflict dynamics in this way, and we care about both peace and justice. And here's how we're going to try to approach this problem. I think one key part of that, however, is the platform has to have a commitment to dignity and utility for people across the political spectrum in a way that, for example, a news organization doesn't necessarily have to, right? Fox or MSNBC are free to chase partisan audiences. And it's probably good that partisan news outlets exist because they're going to cover a particular set of issues within a particular frame in a way that people care about and relate to. But somewhere there needs to be what is sometimes called consensus media. And so this gets back to the, you can't fix society by fixing platform algorithms. It has to be a whole of society effort. And to really make this pointed, I will give the example that someone at a platform told me when I started talking about, well, maybe you should rank news articles higher if they are liked by people across the political spectrum. This is an idea called bridging-based ranking that Aviva Vadia and others have written about. And he said, that's a great idea. Those articles aren't common enough to make a difference. So there's an inventory problem here, right? The platforms can't show people the material that might help transform the conflict to something more healthy because that material doesn't exist. It's not common enough, right? People are writing screeds about racism targeted at people who already think that racism is a problem, right? That's not going to work. You need a different type of content. And unfortunately, everybody in the media ecosystem, from platforms to news organizations to politicians, has an incentive to inflame the conflict, because the easiest way to politically motivate people, to get them engaged, is to make them afraid of what the other side might do if they don't. And there's this term in the conflict literature, which is conflict entrepreneur, which is actually a value neutral term. So I would say that people fighting for racial justice are conflict entrepreneurs. They are drawing upon a pre-existing political division to energize and activate people. You could also say that, like, the sort of MAGA crowd are conflict entrepreneurs. They are drawing across a pre-existing division to activate people. The question of whether that's good or bad comes down to, well, first of all, do you think they're on the side of justice or not? But also, there's a feedback effect. When you activate a division, you motivate people, but you also make the division more salient, and you make it worse. So there's a devil's bargain there that eventually political and media and platform actors are going to have to step out of and say, actually, we know that we can get higher engagement, motivation, activation, et cetera, from really pushing on this conflict. But every time we do that, it makes the conflict worse. And so that's the sort of dwindling spiral of misaligned incentives. And unfortunately, it extends far broader than platforms.
Yeah, and I think this is a really compelling response to the, but what about the paternalism argument, right? Like, that these interventions that are, designed to promote other values are getting in the way of, or they're some sort of like social engineering, they're getting in the way of what people want to do and the free speech of the people. I think it's just this idea that there is no value neutral and that the existing system already promotes certain kinds of behavior. And that there's this recursive effect of it, you go down a spiral. So I completely agree with, the idea that there is no neutral, and that sort of fear of, encoding values is sort of misplaced, because values are already encoded. That's how these platforms work. One thing that I think hampers progress in this area, though, is sort of a lack of common vocabulary. We were talking before about the interdisciplinary nature of a lot of this work, and I think one of the obstacles is there's all of these sort of technical sounding concepts that sound objective and defined, but they're actually really ambiguous. We've talked about some of them today, and you wrote another great post with your co-authors recently about this in the context of amplification and how it's kind of all the rage these days. It's getting invoked in lots of different kinds of legislative models or regulatory models. The idea being that, well, okay, social media platforms maybe shouldn't be responsible for the content that other people post, but they should be responsible for the extent that they amplify that content. That all sounds pretty reasonable. What's the catch? Why is amplification much more complicated than it appears?
Yeah, well, yeah. So the piece you're referencing is called What Will Amplification Mean in Court? And it is a sort of thought experiment of exactly that. We imagine that there's a court case based on, for example, one of the proposed laws, which includes the word amplification. As far as I know, there's no past law anywhere in the world that includes that word, but don't quote me on it. This stuff changes real fast. But anyway, it's popular in legal drafting at this point. And so, you know, there's a court case, right? So someone says, you know, this is defamation, or, you know, this causes harm to children, or this inspired a violent crime, or, you know, whatever, any of the issues that we might be concerned about in moderation. And so now a judge has to decide, okay, did the platform amplify this? You know, the law says amplification. So, okay, is it a fact that this was amplified? And our approach to trying to answer this question was to go and talk to a bunch of people, you know, read the laws, talk to the people drafting them, talk to the scholars who have used this word, and ask them what they meant. And because that's really what it comes down to, right? Like, what is the intention of the word? And we found that there were basically three meanings. The first is a counterfactual. So, you know, if the platform had been different, this would not have been distributed as widely. Okay, so the intuition here comes from the sort of chronological feed, right? You know, if we had a cron feed, then, you know, the algorithms wouldn't have shown this to 2 million more people. So first of all, in any particular instance, that may be true, right? But how do you determine whether that's true? Well, you need to make a claim about something that didn't happen. Okay, well, how does that work? Well, in Twitter's case, they kept a small fraction, I think it's 1% of their users on a chronological feed when they introduced the algorithmic feed in, I think it was 2017. And so they have this sort of control group, and they recently did a paper where they studied the distribution of tweets from left and right wing politicians across 7 countries, computed this thing called the amplification ratio, which was how often did somebody see one of these tweets in the, you know, 1% chronological holdout group versus how often do they see if they're on an algorithm feed. And so that provides a definition of amplification in this counterfactual sense. However, that really only works for Twitter for a couple of reasons. First is that they've already got the control group. You don't have to simulate or imagine the counterfactual. It's right there. The second is that chronological is meaningful for Twitter. It is a platform that is designed around a chronological feed of, you know, more or less people you follow. Chronological is less meaningful for other platforms. It's, you know, kind of meaningful for Facebook, although there you get into questions of, you know, do we include posts from groups? Do we include posts from phrases? Do we include a notification that, you know, someone commented on your post? Like, all kinds of things happen on Facebook, right? Which of those belong in the feed? But you can kind of say that, okay, the chronological feed is a thing that you could do. But what about YouTube? What about Google News? What about Spotify? These are recommender-driven platforms where a chronological feed makes no sense. It would be useless. And so laws stating that, you know, they need an option which is, does not have an algorithm is sort of like, well, okay, like, yes, you can comply with the letter of the law by giving you a chronological feed of every video on YouTube, but like, really? Like, is that what we want? So anyway, this counterfactual problem definition runs into the problem that the counterfactual is often poorly defined. And even if it is well defined, you don't necessarily ever get to know it. You have to get into simulating it. And even worse, you have to simulate what user behavior will be, because user behavior changes when platforms change. And we know that you can get viral cascades, amplification, if you like, just from people sharing things with no algorithm at all, if you look at sort of cascades through WhatsApp and Telegram and so forth. So you're now in the situation where to make a legal judgment, you have to make a very complicated counterfactual situation of the algorithm user system and trust that you can know the results well enough to make a binding legal argument about speech rights. And I don't think we can. I don't think that's reasonable. So that's sort of one definition of amplification that people are getting at. And I think when you stare at it hard, it kind of falls apart. The next definition that people talk about is there's sort of a sleight of hand. Nobody really says this directly, but when you read definitions carefully, there's a group of them that collapse to distributed, right? Amplified cannot be distinguished from distributed. And so one of these definitions is something like, shows the user extreme content at the expense of more moderate content. Okay, so that sounds like it makes sense. The problem is that sentence is trivially true for any type of content. You know, I show the user X content at the expense of non-X content. For any category X, that is a true statement. Because attention is zero sum. There's only so many links on the page of results. There's only so many minutes a day that somebody interacts with a recommender system. So choosing anything is always at the expense of everything else. So there's three or four laws which are sort of written in this at the expense of way. And it sounds great, but it actually doesn't mean anything more than mere distribution. And as soon as you define amplification as distribution, then what you are doing is you are writing classical illegal speech laws. You're just saying, you can't talk about this. This is illegal. And, you know, we all know the challenges there, right? Even news organizations acknowledge that they, quote, amplify something by covering it, right? The libraries are full of books that are full of hate speech, right? You want to be very careful about what you make illegal to say. And in particular, this definition of amplification doesn't distinguish between algorithmic and human editorial decisions, right? So if I am Apple News and I tune my news algorithm to show you more news about, I don't know, the war in Ukraine, and turns out there's a bunch of hate speech in some of the articles on Ukraine, am I liable as an editor? And why wouldn't this apply to journalism organizations as well? So this set of definitions of amplification collapse pretty quickly to just, we want to make a certain type of speech illegal. And then the final definition that we see is, there's something about agency, right? I didn't ask to see this. I saw it anyway. I think there's sort of a very interesting part and a sort of less sensible part. The interesting part is the observation that we need better control over what recommendation systems show us. And there's a lot of work going into, well, how do you build controls for a recommender system, right? People are talking about, like, you can already select topics that you want to follow in many of them. People are talking about, like, you know, diversity sliders or, like, left-right politics sliders or conversational recommenders. Maybe I should be able to tell a system as if it's my personal assessment. Oh, you know, please follow this topic and tell me if there are any developments of this kind, right? So I think that is very sensible. The part of it that starts to be a little weirder is, in a legal sense, so in our hypothetical court case, you could get into a situation where you're trying to decide whether the user actually asked for something or not. So let's say someone searches for politics on Spotify and ends up with a podcast that discusses popular conspiracy theories about politicians. So did they want to see that podcast? Maybe they were interested in the state of politics and the conspiracy theories in it, right? Like, it becomes this really weird sort of trying to get into the head of the user to know what they wanted at any particular point. Even more challenging is the fact that part of the value of recommender systems is that they show you things that you didn't ask for. That's the idea. You're delegating curatorial responsibility. So try to think of Google News, right? If Google News only showed you things that you asked for, it wouldn't be a news system. That's not what news is. The whole point of a news recommender is to prevent you from having to search for the news explicitly.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us.
It's really been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Arbiters of Truth, the Lawfare podcast series on our online information ecosystem. You can find past episodes in the Lawfare podcast feed and on our separate Arbiters of Truth feed, and we'll be back with another episode next Thursday. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare Materials supporter at patreon.com/lawfare, where you'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. This podcast was edited by the good people at Goat Rodeo, and our audio engineer this episode was Goat Rodeo's Kara Schillen. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.